This is Mile High.
We have to do it better in order to move people along.
Up, down, inside out.
If you get your mind right,
it is not. It is a receiver of thought.
Because love is my first technique.
It's now time for the show.
Welcome to the Mile High Podcast. This is your host, Dr. Daniel Knowles. Thank you for being a consistent listener to the Mile High Podcast, which you can find on iTunes and Stitcher and YouTube and many other channels internationally. And if this is your first episode you're listening to, whatever way you're grabbing access to this, hit subscribe. We'd love to have you never miss an episode. And of course, remember to mark your calendar and permanent ink now for our annual event. The next one will be the weekend of August 16th to 19th in Colorado, the Mile High City. We look forward to seeing you there. This episode, I am so, I will just say, stoked to be doing an interview with this phenomenal guest who I've been a big fan and friend of for so many years. Joining us on this episode is none other than Christopher Kent. He's a chiropractor, first and foremost, and an attorney. He's CEO of On Purpose. He now resides in Sparkle City, serving chiropractic on campus at the center of the chiropractic universe. He's obviously involved with the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation Research, and he just really has a passion for facilitating human empowerment. He originally joined the Palmer faculty after graduating, and while at Palmer, he was elected to President Student Senate, worked as principal investigator on so many research projects, active member of the State Bar of California, and he's really known within and without within chiropractic and outside of chiropractic in so many ways, and serves in the editorial board for many journals and ICA Researcher of the Year, as well as many other accolades. So welcome to the Mile High Podcast, Dr. Christopher Kent.
Thank you, Danny. It's always a pleasure.
I know, and you know, I'm realizing now that maybe between On Purpose episodes, Mile High episodes, and Donald's episodes on Purpose, we may be the most interviewed family with you.
That may be true.
Quite possibly. And most times I've gotten to interview, there's a lot of interactions, and plus Sherman Connect. So I'm grateful to get this time with you here. And we are coming off our Mile High weekend, and we had a big impact for the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation Research, raising upwards of $55,000 for the organization. So I thought it'd be a good time to let's have a good science research conversation about subluxation and chiropractic, and who better to do that with than yourself.
Oh, well, thank you.
So let's start off with something that I think would be great for our listeners, which is so frequently some of the detractors from chiropractic will say, well, there's no evidence for subluxation or no evidence for chiropractic working. What is some of the thing? And we know that that's not true. And we also know we can need to continue to build more evidence. That's why research is important. What are some of the things that there are evidence for relative to subluxation and adjustment that really excite you and that you find really enthralling?
Well, first of all, when people suggest that there's no evidence for subluxation, the first response I come up with, well, what evidence will you accept? And that usually causes them to stop short, because the fact of the matter is that the way a so-called disease becomes enshrined in medicine is really a matter of politics and consensus. When I served as chair of the NGO Health Committee at the UN, I had access to people at WHO, of course. And I asked what I thought was a pretty straightforward question. I said, what are the criteria for something getting an ICD code? How does a so-called new disease or condition become vetted? And emails went back and forth and back and forth, and I just got this evasive gobbledygook. And finally, this one person who was actually on vacation at the time said, you know, your email was forwarded to me. And she said, I've been trying to get the same information for years and never got a satisfactory response. And what it boiled down to is, you know, they vote them in. So that's the scientific process for getting ICD codes for such things as struck by an orca, burns caused by water skis on fire, encounter with spacecraft. You know, those codes are voted in. And again, if you ascribe credibility to that process, there are codes for the vertebral subluxation complex, for foraminal and central canal stenosis associated with it, and so forth. So, you know, for one thing, the World Health Organization, through the ICD process, has acknowledged that there is such a thing. There have been a number of publications, for example, Kirk Erickson's book on upper cervical subluxation complex. And it's really not. It's about full spine, because he has hundreds and hundreds of articles from the medical and chiropractic literature that supports this concept of vertebral subluxation. And again, it's published by a major scientific publishing firm. I sometimes hear people say, well, I've never seen a subluxation. Well, then perhaps you should obtain a copy of Bill Rook's atlas, where he has cadaveric dissections, x-rays, MRIs, CT scans, and so forth, showing the tangible effects of vertebral subluxation. I hear people say, well, where's the evidence for any kind of visceral involvement? Well, there's a book called Somatovisceral Aspects of Chiropractic, an Evidence-Based Approach. I mean, these are books by major publishers, and I could go on and on. We have four peer-reviewed journals in the profession devoted to vertebral subluxation-related research. And what it all real boils down to is, how do you define it? What's your operational definition for subluxation? Which means simply, how do we detect it? And we have a lot of technologies that detect it pretty well. And the criteria for that is reliability and validity. Reliability is just reproducibility. If you do it and I do it, well, we get the same or similar results. And everything from NSA heel tension tests to certain x-ray analysis protocols to thermal scanning have been shown to have exceptionally high levels of reliability or reproducibility. The second thing is validity. And validity is, you know, does it measure what it claims to measure? And you might say, well, you know, that sounds like kind of an obvious thing, but it really isn't. I remember getting into an argument with a chiropractic college instructor who claimed that surface EMG wasn't valid. And I said, well, why isn't it valid? And he said, well, it doesn't correlate with pain. And I said, well, first of all, there are some studies that suggest that it might, but let's not go there. It's a motor nerve test. It's not to measure pain. If you want to measure pain, do something else. I said, you know, you can't weigh a patient with a rectal thermometer, but that doesn't mean it doesn't have clinical utility. So when the validity issue comes up, you have to come up with valid for what. So common to all models of subluxation of the spine are two things: some kind of biomechanical phenomenon and some kind of neurological phenomenon. So we minimally need to have reliable and valid means for assessing each of those two things. And I'm delighted to say that I think that the support we have for the VSC model is certainly as robust or more robust than the support for any sort of musculoskeletal intervention, where the findings are equivocal. You know, they've said manipulation is either no worse than a placebo or, you know, almost as good as an educational booklet, you know, things of this nature. And, you know, I feel very confident in where we are today with chiropractic, but we have a long way to go.
Well, and there's no doubt that anything in the health sciences needs to continue to do research and build evidence and learn more.
I just read a paper in the scientific journal. It was talking about what evidence is there to support primary care medical practice. And they looked at the most popular procedures that are used in primary care medicine. And basically the number they came up with was 18%. I mean, this was just this year. Back in 1991, David Eddy came up with the figure of 15%. And again, this isn't gratuitous medic bashing. This is just saying that's the state of the art that our society accepts as the de facto standard. And given the incredible safety of chiropractic, and given its over a century long track record of clinical satisfaction by patients, seeing people respond to chiropractic care that haven't to other forms of care, I just don't think it's reasonable to hold us to a more burdensome standard than a science and philosophy that has been shown to be one of the leading causes of human mortality.
Absolutely, truly. And with that, one of the things that I thought of as I was hearing this was one of the areas of evidence that I love that Rob Sinnott points out very frequently was, well, what is Medicare paying for then? The only thing they pay for is subluxation care. So there's another governmental, you know, political area.
Well, again, if we want to go to things that are non-clinical, but very important to decision makers and people who are concerned with public policy, we can look at the spectacular cost savings that have been associated with people under long-term chiropractic care versus the general population.
Right.
You know, there was a paper published that showed that individuals that could have the option of seeing a chiropractor first had spectacular reductions in medical utilization. And one figure that comes to mind is an 85% decrease in pharmaceutical costs. Looking at a senior citizen population, since you mentioned Medicare,
right.
There was a study looking at people who had been under chiropractic care for 5 years or more, and that could be as few as 4 visits a year.
Right.
So it wasn't a high standard. And those individuals not only had a spectacular reduction in number of medical visits, around half, their healthcare costs were less than a third of those in the general population. And some people criticized that and they said, well, that's because these are more health conscious people. But when they controlled for that by using an SF-36 survey, they found there was no statistically significant difference. So what we're seeing consistently in these studies is that chiropractic care is extremely cost effective and that we have levels of patient satisfaction second to none. But what we're looking to do in the Foundation for Vertebral Subluxation Research, which I'm proud to serve as president of, is generalized indicators of physiological well-being as well as positive health outcomes that are measurable. One of the things that we're looking at, and there was a case study recently published, to my knowledge the first, looking at telomere length in a patient who was under chiropractic care. And telomeres, they've been likened to the kind of the plastic ends on your shoelaces that keep them from unraveling. And basically, long telomeres are a good thing and short telomeres are not, and telomere length correlates to aging. And this particular patient actually had an increase in telomere length after a course of chiropractic care, even though she continued, hopefully not for long, some of the less than wonderful health habits she had, like a lot of soda consumption and things of that nature. So we're planning a larger study looking at that. One thing we're very excited about is looking at how prevalent subluxation is in the world. You know, people say, well, chiropractors claim everyone has a subluxation. And we're saying, well, okay, if we have specific criteria to define what a subluxation is, and those criteria have been shown to be reliable and valid, how many people meet those criteria? And, you know, I'm pretty confident we'll find out, yes, you know, almost everyone is subluxated. You know, we've said for years, you know, this is either pandemic or epidemic. And the same thing is true. I just heard an interview with a dentist today talking about, you know, the prevalence of gum disease, of periodontitis and gingivitis and so forth, like how it sets up a chronic inflammatory process. So looking at how prevalent subluxation is, looking at how it affects certain health outcomes, not just patient perceived quality of life, although that's an important part of it, but physiologic indicators too. things like telomere length, things like DNA repair enzymes, things like inflammation, things like oxidative stress. By looking at some of these biomarkers and potentially showing what changes occur when a person's under care, I think we can get beyond this antiquated notion of, well, what diseases go away if a person is subluxated and gets under chiropractic care.
Absolutely. And we need to continue to do that. What are some of the things that the foundation has? Well, first of all, let's talk about the foundation, the vertebral subluxation research. What is it? Why does it exist? What are they about? Let's talk about that. That might be foreign to people that are listening to this.
Indeed, that's a great start. I was speaking with Dr. McCoy, who was a key player in this. Actually, he probably does more work than anyone else in this area. And about 7 or 8 years ago, myself and several other people were concerned about the future of chiropractic. That question that Reggie Gold used to always talk about. If you were the last chiropractor on earth, would chiropractic survive? And of course, my response to that is, of course, because if I were the only chiropractor left on earth, the people that are trying to destroy it would be gone, and yeah, it would survive. But basically, what we really meant to say was, you know, will we be able to change this profession so that people realize what gift they have to offer humanity? So this concern about legacy is what began to drive it. And what we saw was that there was a paucity or an almost complete lack of quality research published in peer-reviewed journals that answered some of these questions. So we came up with a research agenda, and the research agenda addressed such issues as, okay, do subluxations exist? How do we determine that? How can we assess reliability and validity? How does this fit into an operational definition of a subluxation that we can use as a part of an experimental design? And that was just kind of the beginning. And one of the global projects that we're working on now is the development of practice guidelines, which are essential to protect subluxation-centered chiropractors legally and on many other levels as well. And it's just the right thing to do, is to find out what are we doing that's reliable and valid. How can we get a handle on this thing we call subluxation, measure it, determine with acceptable scientific means what happens when people are under various forms of chiropractic care. So that's part of it, and that's a big piece. As I said, the other is what's the prevalence of subluxation in the community? The second is, what are some of the tools that we have? We've also had some papers, such as a paper by Curtis Fedorchuk on the cervical curve, which debunked some of the claims that are out there as to how this is just kind of a transient muscular contraction thing, and, you know, that there's really a lot more to it than that. So what blew my mind was when I got our report last year of what we've done and how much money we've done it with. And for less than $250,000, less than $200,000+, we were able to get over 40 papers presented or published.
Wow.
I think that's just absolutely phenomenal. You know, I hear other organizations in chiropractic talking about, oh, we need $1 million for this study, you know, for one study. And yes, some of them are case reports and some of them are higher levels of evidence. But the point is, we haven't been blowing our horn very loud, and most people don't know that we exist. And we want to engage the profession more on several levels, not just as donors, but as participants. We're going to start a practice-based research network where doctors in the field can participate in our research projects. And I've often said, can you imagine what the skeptics and the detractors would have to say if they were faced with large multi-center trials involving thousands of patients in collaboration with major universities and published in quality journals? Now what are they going to say? And we're certainly moving in that direction.
Yeah, absolutely. And I want to say something, because I've been involved with conversations, as you're aware of, about research agendas within the chiropractic profession. Mm-hmm. And one area that people may not be aware of with the foundation is that they're very focused on being sure that the research they do uses the terminology that's our chiropractic terminology, subluxation and adjustment. And we know that other research papers are often quoted by chiropractors and often being published with other terminology like manipulation and lesion and other areas. Can you illuminate for people why that's important to discern that?
Well, first and foremost, there is a difference. The suggestion that it's just a semantic game, or that the words are interchangeable or nearly synonymous, is simply wrong. There's a profound difference epistemologically as well as operationally in what we're doing, manipulating a joint or adjusting a vertebral subluxation for its reduction for the fullest expression of life. Operationally, joint fixation determined by motion palpation and manipulation applied primarily for pain relief is a pretty shaky procedure. The literature holds that it is at best modest in its effect, and some of the literature suggests that it's no better than a placebo. Motion palpation is notoriously not reproducible, not that it doesn't have some value, but it's certainly not anywhere near the subluxation indicators that are used, and the purpose is completely different. We're not trying to educatedly ameliorate pain by applying a force to the area that's often symptomatic. That's one thing. Chiropractic, looking at vertebral subluxation, has reliable and valid means of assessing both the biomechanical change and the neurological change. And as you well know from your years of clinical experience, the point of intervention, where you apply the force, is often not the area of symptomatology.
Oh, wow.
So there's a completely different paradigm. There's a completely different worldview, and it's not just philosophical, it's operational. It's what you're actually doing in practice. Now, to go back to your question of why does this matter, it matters for a number of reasons, and I'll just touch on a couple, legal and legislative. I was recently consulted by a group of chiropractors in a country, and again, it's privileged, so I can't share the name of the country with you, but they were trying to obtain a chiropractic law. And basically what the politicians and lobbyists told them was, yeah, we don't think we need chiropractors. Well, why not? Because we have physical therapists and they perform spinal manipulation. And the chiropractor said, well, what we do is different. And they said, well, that's not what your researchers are saying. They're saying the terms are interchangeable. That's why it's important. This isn't just a word game. If we don't have something unique to offer, if we're just one of many purveyors of manipulative therapy, we're going to lose.
Right.
Because the manipulative therapists that are going to win are those that are in the medical system and have the cultural authority. But if we can show that we have a service that's not competitive with medicine, that is salutogenic in nature, that is, it's looking for causes of health, and it's all about empowering individuals to express their innate potential, that's something that's not being done in medicine.
Right, absolutely.
And when people say that's airy-fairy and it's just, you know, hippoloid gobbledygook, that's not true at all. We're seeing the emergence of literature that supports this concept. We recently reviewed a report of a paper that was looking at individuals that had known genetic aberrations that were associated with identifiable clinical diseases. And they said, you know, not everyone with a genetic aberration expresses the disease. And they said, wouldn't it be great if we could identify what factors there are in that person that makes such a determination? And it's the same question DD raised that started it all.
Right.
When he wanted to know why two men working at the same job, at the same bench, eating the same food, identical environmental dynamics, one would be healthy and the other would not. And that's what got this whole thing started. And as chiropractic philosophy evolved from a better way of dealing with disease to a means of helping individuals express their potential as human beings and using sophisticated technologies to do so and to have measurable outcomes, to me, this is a very exciting direction for the profession.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. And I'm very glad and grateful for everybody who's doing the work that they're doing with the foundation. Can you take
a moment? Obviously, much of it is volunteer work.
Right. You know, I understand
that. We need money, to be frank. I know everybody says they need money, but we really do. You know, when we do collaborative projects with major universities, we often have to pay those investigators and pay those fees. You know, telomere studies aren't cheap. DNA repair enzyme studies aren't cheap. Functional MRIs aren't cheap. So if we're going to do that level of research and that level of technology, again, using metrics and procedures that are already accepted in the scientific community as being global indicators of well-being, we need support.
And
we also need the numbers in terms of patients and doctors that are participating. So not only do we need your money, we need your participation.
And your data, right?
Yeah, your data, exactly.
Right, and so the thing to remember about that, and we will definitely put in the blog notes that people can donate, and it's great that now they have that monthly donation option because many people will think of their budgets that way and
sure,
be an ongoing thing, which will be very helpful for foundation and future research. So we're really grateful that A, that's set up, and they were grateful somebody step up in realizing that. And, you know, just correct me if I'm wrong, there's not a big amount of governmental loan, you know, grants to chiropractic research that are just about to come our way, is there?
Well, unfortunately, the grants that are related to so-called chiropractic research that go to so-called chiropractic institutions deal primarily with the episodic symptomatic treatment of musculoskeletal pain syndrome.
Right.
And, you know, kind of the medical paradigm is you enter the system, you go through some sort of triage, they come up with a diagnosis, and then you say, okay, what's the cheapest thing we got that'll address this in terms of a balance between cost and effectiveness? And if your disease isn't on the list or if your procedure isn't on the list, you know, you're not going to get there. So in this integrated setting that many people are promoting, someone, probably not a chiropractor, is going to say, well, let's see, you've got uncomplicated back pain, and we've tried the analgesics and the muscle relaxants, and you've had a couple sessions of physical therapy, so let's try manipulation and see if that works. In that kind of a model, how many newborn infants who are subluxated by the birth process will ever be seen? How many children with somewhat amorphous neurodevelopmental disorders will ever be seen? And, you know, one of the joys of doing On Purpose, which is, you know, a monthly subscription service, is presenting some of these cases. And we hear about people who have had just life-disrupting issues for years, sometimes for decades, turn around after a short course of chiropractic care. And that's why it's essential that we be a direct access profession that's separate from the medical system, but not competitive with it, so that we can see these things happen.
Absolutely. 1,000%. And I'm grateful that the foundation is spearheading that. And we need more people to help with that. I'd like to ask two more things before we start wrapping up. A, who are some of the key people that, you know, the unsung heroes, so to speak, that are working with the foundation? Often people think of yourself and Matthew McCoy, but who else?
Well, you know, Matt is, in my opinion, one of the most underappreciated people in chiropractic. He's just not the blustering megalomaniac that we often see on the stage. Curtis Fedorchuk has done all kinds of work. Again, largely volunteer work out of the goodness of his heart and his commitment to chiropractic. Christy Kwan, who is our executive director, has worked tireless hours mostly volunteer hours to do the things that are necessary to keep the ball rolling. So we have those are some that come to mind off of the top of my head, and undoubtedly there are many more. So I don't want anyone to feel slighted. But the point is, these are people who love chiropractic and are working behind the scenes to ensure that it will be here after we're gone, and to ensure that you can still practice it while you're still here.
And I appreciate people, you.
Well, you know better than anyone how fragile your practice is.
I've personally had to deal with it many times, and
yes.
So when you have to deal with that, you know, right in your face or in your lap, then you realize that you have to do something, and that's where a lot of my drive comes from. And I would like to say this relative to some of the things you said that I'm really glad you mentioned is that intersection of all science and research, and you have the people that are very philosophical or very technique-driven, and maybe we'll poo-poo science on research or we don't need it. Unfortunately, hopefully people through this episode podcast got how important it is. But there's this intersection of people say philosophy, science, and art. I personally have said for years and years that it's a four-legged stool, not a three-legged one, but philosophy, science, art, and business. And all of those intersect, and that they're all so important. And with and then you can even add politics, right? That having the appropriate science and research in there, you know, those other legs of that stool, your politics, your philosophy, your art, and your business are going to not do as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, whenever policy issues come up, whenever board issues come up, someone says, you know, hey, can you send me some research that, you know, fill in the blank? And sometimes I can and sometimes I can't. But, you know, people don't think about it until they're in trouble with their board.
Right.
Or until there's potentially negative legislation pending in their state or country. So you mentioned all of those dimensions. You know, Simon Senzon is very passionate about Ken Wilber's work and the integral model and how all of this stuff interfaces. And I think we need to stop thinking of pigeonholes and compartments and start thinking of a global holographic interaction between all of these dynamics, which makes one successful, however you choose to define that, in expressing your potential. You know, you're successful if you're getting what you want, and you're happy, and you're serving others. You know,
absolutely.
And if that isn't happening, there's an imbalance somewhere.
And you mentioned it, but I think it bears reference one more time for our listeners, which is you mentioned the importance of guidelines. And obviously, you've been involved numerous times with other guidelines, and I've referenced them in my own challenges with boards and associations and chiropractic educational systems and serving on the Sherman board. You know, the Council on Chiropractic Practice Guidelines, CCP guidelines. However, why is this crucial now to have work done on guidelines in the subluxation-centered area?
Mainly because they're lacking. We don't have contemporary guidelines for vertebral subluxation-centered chiropractic that enjoy the credibility that some of these earlier guidelines that we had developed and you had mentioned have, such as inclusion in the National Guidelines Clearinghouse or at the Healthcare Guidelines Directory, things of this nature. And guidelines are very different in my perspective than some of the rather prescriptive and restrictive guidelines that we see in the musculoskeletal field. And if people on the outside just look at anything that has the word chiropractic on it, without understanding the distinction between musculoskeletal, manipulative, and physical therapy for pain relief and correction of vertebral subluxations to allow the nervous system to function without interference so people can live their life to their potential, we got a problem. So we need to create those guidelines. They need to be credible, and it's a monumental job. Again, going back to your earlier question, you know, what evidence do we have to support chiropractic? What research? Why is it taking so long to produce the guidelines? To go through all that stuff and to condense it and put it in a digestible form and relate it to clinical practice. You know, the problem isn't, there's no research, you know, there are 10 papers, we can do the guidelines this afternoon. But if we have thousands of papers we have to screen, and probably a thousand or more will probably end up in there, ultimately, it's a lot of work.
Yeah.
And it takes time. It takes subject energy, and it's money. But its value is phenomenal. If someone calls you before a board and says, these guidelines say you shouldn't x-ray someone until 6 or 8 weeks after the initiation of care. Just bang on the part that hurts, and if you haven't killed or paralyzed him by then do the imaging you should have done on day one. I'd be facetious, but it's not facetious at all when you get hauled before a board and you're confronted with that. And you say, well, the guidelines that are applicable to my chiropractic practice say this. And in fact, we have a paper that's going to be coming out very soon that reviewed the various abnormalities that were seen on radiographs taken at three different chiropractic college clinics. And in some cases, in the cervical spine at one institution, it was like 90%+ had something clinically significant, like an occipitalization or a block vertebra or an asymmetric spinous process that might mislead you on palpation, as well as frank pathologies like, abdominal aortic aneurysms and neoplasms and stuff like that. So there's a lot more to this than red flags. So where does this information come from? Well, we gather it and digest it and put it in review articles and put it in clinical practice guidelines and so forth. So when they say, Dr. Knowles, we want to take your license because we've got 20 instances here of people that you x-rayed without waiting 6 to 8 weeks that didn't have red flags according to your history. And so, whoa, wait a minute. If I'm going to introduce a force into a spine, that's a whole lot different than prescribing an analgesic where you might be able to get away with waiting a couple weeks. But if I'm going to introduce a force into a spine with the intent of there being a change in nervous system function, I better know what's in there.
Right.
And so forth. And again, without mandating it, but having practitioner discretion as well. But the point is, you need guidelines that are congruent with your philosophy and your practice. And that's what we're working to produce.
Yeah, absolutely.
And when you present those to your board and they say, oh, well, where did these come from? You say, well, they're included in the Agency for Healthcare Quality and Research National Guideline Clearinghouse. Oh, what are they going to say?
Right. And that's necessary. And so we're grateful. And I kept saying that so much through Mile High of why I wanted people to support the foundation, because this is a huge project on the agenda. It's vital. And the time is now for that. So we are so grateful the foundation's doing that work among the many other projects they're doing and want them to get, full support. So,
and our pledge to the profession is that we are focused on vertebral subluxation research. We're not going to take your money, tell you we're doing subluxation research, and then publish a paper on spinal manipulation.
You can even say that effing foundation is for focused.
Yes. I like that. There are good F's and there are bad F's. F's got a bad rap, It's the lowest grade in school. It's associated with expletives, but, there's a good side to F.
Well, thank you for, continuing to be such a beacon for chiropractic in so many ways that you've served, too many to mention, and currently also being at Sherman College. And I know that people are enjoying you being enjoying your presence there, and I know that you're enjoying being present there.
Yeah, it's working out very well. It was a gamble. I reached my 65th birthday and, there was no one left that I needed to stay with, so I came here.
Yeah, and it's a great thing for chiropractic and for, of course, Sherman College. So thank you again for taking your time out of your busy schedule for joining us in the Mile High podcast episode. Is there any final thing that you want to share with the audience briefly?
One thing that I often close my talks with is that the decisions you make and the actions you take affect not only your future and those you touch, but that of humanity as a whole. So that, an acknowledgement of all that you and Rochelle and so forth are doing for chiropractic, it's appreciated. And I appreciate the opportunity to share with your audience.
Thank you so much. And again, thank you everyone for listening, for being part of the Mile High audience and listening to our podcast. Share this episode with someone else, most certainly. And, you know, put a, if you enjoy it, share it somehow via social media or forward the email. And please become a supporter of the foundation up on their website now. And again, the link will be in the blog notes. You can find very easily a link to donate on a monthly basis. And there's all kinds of range. I mean, you can go from, you know, thousands a month to a small, you know, a cup of coffee a month in terms of donation and supporting chiropractic research. And every little bit will help. And we hope, we look forward to seeing everybody. Mark your calendar now. No ifs, ands, or buts. Clear it. Next year, August 16th to 19th, 2018, www.milehighchiro.org. Right now, registration's half of what it's going to be at the door, and that's only for the month of September, so people want to take action on that. Thank you, Dr. Kent, and thank you for continuing to serve chiropractic. Like our page on Facebook, www.facebook.com/milehighchiro.